Lecture 15. Come back carrying your shield or on it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. In our last lecture, we focused on the role of male Spartans in the Agoge and what was expected of them in Spartan society. In the first part of this lecture, it's the women's turn. And along the way, we'll see some of the differences between Spartan and other Greek women. Then in the second part of the lecture, I want to discuss in some detail why and when the Agoge was introduced. And finally, what I hope will take us nicely into the third part of the lecture, I want to talk about the origins of Sparta's Peloponnesian League. So we'll begin with Spartan women. Spartan women had more independence and rights than their counterparts in Athens. There is a very big difference between women in Sparta and women in Athens. For example, Spartan women could own land, even if they had brothers. And in the 4th century, Aristotle talks about 2/5 of the land of Laconia being owned by women. Aristotle doesn't agree with this. He thinks that women should not own land because elsewhere in Greece, they don't. So this was another reason then why the Spartans were different from the other Greeks. We've seen that the kleros, the allotment, was the basis for full citizenship in Sparta. So evidently, there was also private ownership of land because Spartan women were not presented with kleroi, only the male babies were, which was then, of course, given to them once they graduated the Agoge. This situation that women owned land in Laconia may be a reflection that by the 4th century BC, the kleros ceased to be returned to the state when the Spartiate died. It remained in the possession of his family. Either way, Spartan women could own land, and as I said, that sets them apart from other women on the mainland that we know about. Aristotle's point that 2/5 of the land of Laconia was owned by women may not be an exaggeration, as is sometimes thought. There was a high death rate among Spartan soldiers. Manpower declined dramatically during the classical period, something I want to talk about in our next lecture as we wrap up Sparta and bring in the Persians. This decline in manpower and the fact that Spartan men were always busy in some way or another with warfare also explains why Spartan women played a more overt role in public life than elsewhere. Plutarch tells us this, that women played a far more hands-on role in public affairs than their counterparts in Athens. And the Spartan men allowed them to do this. In fact, Plutarch even says that the men of Sparta obeyed their wives, giving us some sort of interesting dynamic between the husband and wife relationship in Sparta. Remember, in Athens, the man, the husband, was the lord and master, the Kyrios. He wasn't going to take orders from his wife. But that was because Athenian society and its expectations were very different from the Spartan one. Women were expected to take more of a role in civic life in Sparta because the men were always away fighting or on training missions. If the lot of the Spartan man was to graduate the Agoge and fight for the state, then the lot of the Spartan woman was to bear strong babies. That's why the lifestyles of girls and boys in Sparta was utterly different from that in Athens. Until the age of 7, boys and girls trained together in Sparta. And Plutarch, in his Life of Lycurgus, tells us that this was to help them cope better with pregnancy and so produce stronger babies. Obviously, we're talking about the girls here. Plutarch actually says this, and I'm quoting here, "Lycurgus made the girls physically strong by having them run, wrestle, and throw the discus and javelin, so that their children, even in the womb," he says, "even in the womb, would have a strong start in fit bodies and so develop better. And the women would handle their pregnancies well and give birth successfully and in relaxed fashion. Well, I've been present at the birth of both of my children. And while they emerged successfully, thank goodness, I'm not entirely certain that my wife is all that relaxed. Even after the separation of boys and girls at age 7, the girls continued with the physical training. And as a result, Spartan women had a reputation among the Greeks for toughness. In Aristophanes' Lysistrata, a comedy produced in Athens in 411 BC, so during the Peloponnesian War, a Spartan lady by the name of Lampito is praised by Lysistrata and complimented by her for her muscular physique and physical prowess. Lampito replies by saying that she can still jump. She's probably a sort of middle-aged by now, perhaps. She can still jump and still kick her buttocks with her feet before landing. Now, this type of exercise, jumping up, kicking your buttocks, and getting your feet down and flat again before you landed, was characteristic of the Spartans. But it's not easy to do. I'm not going to try it in the studio. I recommend you don't try it at home. More than the reputation for toughness was the Spartan women's attitude towards their children dying nobly for the state. We hear of one mother, for example, whose son returned from battle. And when she asked how the battle had gone, he said, "All have perished." Instead of being overjoyed that her son was the one who made it home safely, she grabbed a tile, so the story goes, and threw it at him, killing him. In the process, asking, "Why was it you who was sent to bring us the bad news?" In other words, why didn't you perish with your comrades in arms? Why was it you who survived to bring the bad news? You brought shame on me. Dishonor, then, was equally important for the family of the Spartiate as it was for the warrior himself. We mentioned that last time, the shame factor. The only Spartans who were allowed to have their names on tombstones were those who died in battle or who died in childbirth. And this explains why the Spartans stood fast in battle and died, rather than living by the motto of running away to fight another day. That would be my motto, by the way. We know that the Spartan man could marry when he was in his 20s, but he couldn't move home and live at home until he was 30. That meant that his children would have been brought up by the mother, who was living at home all the time, and the sons might experience home life with mum and dad together under one roof only for a couple of years or so, if there was a son who was fast approaching 7 when it was time for him to leave and join the Syssitium. So the dynamic then between parents and children in Sparta was quite different from that in Athens, where, of course, when the children were born, they lived at home right away, and so did the parents. It was like the nuclear family. But any idea that Spartan children were smothered in some way and brought up as mummy's boys is shown to be false by the number of sayings that are attributed to Spartan women about their children. And these stories circulated widely in the Greek world. In another work, Plutarch gives us a number of these sayings. And here are some of my favorites. The first one. When an Athenian woman asked a certain Gorgo of Sparta why Spartan women were the only women to tell their men what to do, Gorgo replied it was, and I quote here, "because Spartan women were the only ones who were mothers of real men." Now that's the sort of line that could start a bar fight. Another saying concerns a mother who is burying her son. As she does so, an old woman approaches her. She offers her her condolences. And she says, "What bad luck brought this on?" The mother replies her, this is the mother who's burying her son, replies that it's actually good luck, not bad, because she gave birth to him, quote, "so that he might die for Sparta. And this is the one thing that has happened for me." One last saying, if I can. And this is the celebrated one of the Spartan mother who is farewelling her son as he goes off to battle. And she tells him to come back carrying your shield or on it. In other words, come back alive in glory because Sparta won the battle, or come back dead. In other words, come back being carried on your shield. I usually bring in a modern analogy here into my classes with the families of suicide bombers. These families appear ecstatic in TV interviews that their son or daughter has just blown himself or herself up along with numerous innocent people. And probably more than anything else, this Spartan analogy here, the sorts of sayings I've been giving you about the mothers to their Spartan children, the sorts of attitudes that Spartan women have about their children, this actually makes the students understand the reactions of the families of suicide bombers. A sobering note, I know, but another example of how the ancient world can help us try to understand or get to grips with the modern. Because the Spartans were obsessed with wives producing healthy male babies, the females married in their late teens. The Spartans believed an older girl was better able to bear the burden of pregnancy and childbirth, as we noted in the quote I gave earlier in this lecture. In Athens, the husband was typically in his early 30s and his wife was 12 or 13. This was because the Athenians were obsessed with their wives being virgins on marriage, because in Athenian society, only legitimate children could inherit the oikos or family unit. However, the Spartan preoccupation with strong and plentiful male babies gave rise to the practice of wife sharing, where three or more men, very often brothers, would share one wife. And offspring from these extramarital liaisons, which is what they were, belonged equally to all of them, or a particular couple if this was outside the immediate family. Now don't start thinking of modern swinging or swapping. The Spartans were the most unswinger-like people you could come across. But when wives had sex with other men to become pregnant, it was because that marriage might have few or no children. So a wife with a dozen children or so, well, maybe not a dozen, but a wife with several children was most likely a good bet to produce more. This assumes, of course, that the man she was going to have sex with was not shooting blanks. Some women started off the extramarital process themselves, and this contributed to the Greek view of Spartan women as promiscuous. At the same time, the Spartans were ahead of the other Greeks here because they were in effect practicing selective breeding, eugenics. As Plutarch says, it's logical to select the best parents when you're breeding horses and dogs, so why not with children? Domestic life then was radically different in Sparta than it was, say, in Athens. While wives stayed at home in both cities, in both polis, in Athens, the husband lived at home all the time, but not so in Sparta until he was 30. And even then, remember, he was expected to live and eat at his Syssition in the evenings and at the weekends. By the time he moved home, his wife had established herself as head of the household. So she was seen as a sort of combination mother and father figure to the children. Also, as we've already said, if the husband happened to have impregnated his wife upon marriage in the 20s, he would have had no family life with his children, and a son at age 7 would be moving out of the house and into his Syssition anyway. So the relationship between parents and children was so very different. And perhaps this is another reason why the Greeks looked down their noses as they did at the Spartans. We've talked a fair bit about Spartan society and the agoge. And now it's time to turn to the second part of my lecture, a consideration of when and why the agoge was introduced. For these factors, we need to bring in the other type of people that the Spartans had intimate dealings with, and these are the helots. Now, if you think being a trembler or an inferior or a perioikos in Spartan society was bad, you wouldn't want to go back in your time machine as a helot. Helots were state-owned serfs. They had no political, no social, and no judicial rights. They came with the kleros when it was given to the successful graduate of the agoge. So it's a sort of weird situation, because although the state of Sparta owned the helots, each Spartiate had a bunch of helots working the land for him. They farmed his kleros because that was what enabled him to continue membership of his syssitium. If Plutarch has it right, the helots gave 70 bushels of barley for each Spartan man and 12 for his wife, along with oil and wine. They were allowed to keep the rest of their produce for themselves, though, and they could even sell any surpluses. But as long as they handed over what was expected of them, they were pretty much left alone to continue working the land. Working the land in this way, as I said, gave the Spartiate the means to pay his syssitium dues to maintain his membership of the barracks. It also gave him the leisure time to fight and be carried back on his shield. Now, this is important because we're not really talking of a conscript army here as elsewhere in Greece. This was the problem with conscript armies. Farmers, etc., traders, just aren't fighting all the time. They're not on military maneuvers all the time. The Spartans needed this. They needed to have a professional army, to use that term. But the Spartan soldier couldn't do that and farm lands at the same time. And that's where the helots took over. And the helots are perhaps the reason for the introduction of the agoge and that radical reorganization of Spartan society when, as we said in the previous lecture, Sparta was developing like any other polis, economically, artistically, then all of a sudden it stops. So let's explore this angle now, helots and the agoge. During the archaic period then, as I said, things were going well for the Spartans. But unlike the other polis, the Spartans do not appear to have been solving any land hunger problems by sending out colonies. They did send out one colony. This was to southern Italy, a place called Taras, and it was probably a penal colony. What the Spartans did, though, was to take over the land of the area neighbouring them. In other words, while things were going well economically and artistically like the other polis, the Spartans were facing the same land hunger problems. Instead of sending out colonies, though, as the other polis were doing, they decided to march into the neighbouring area to the west called Messenia. And they conquered the people and they turned the people of Messenia into slaves, whom they called helots. And why did they go to Messenia? Well, it's because it was close by. The other thing is that the land there was very fertile. So by taking over Messenia and by turning the people into helots, they in effect solved their land hunger problems. Instead of sending out a colony or something, they simply annexed Messenia. Now, when they did this is not exactly known, but it's in a campaign that modern historians call the First Messenian War. And as I said, although an exact date is uncertain, it's traditionally dated to about 740 to 720 BC. We know next to nothing about what happened during the First Messenian War. The Spartans destroyed the Messenians' capital at Messene, but the Messenians themselves didn't give in easily. Most of the fighting took place around the stronghold of Mount Ithome in northern Messenia. Eventually, though, the Spartans conquered the Messenians. About a century later, these Messenians, or Helots as they're now called, revolted. And that forced the Spartans to intervene in Messenia again, what's called the Second Messenian War. Now, this is traditionally dated to 670 to 650 BC. And again, we know next to nothing about it. But if you remember, it was about this time that Phidon of Argos, the tyrant Phidon, defeated the Spartans at the Battle of Hissiae. That was in 669, 668, about that time. So it's very likely then that the Spartan defeat at the hands of Phidon encouraged the Helots to revolt. When the Spartans finally put down this revolt, when the Spartans brought to an end the Second Messenian War, they exiled the main instigators to Sicily. I like it, because these men, these exiled Helots, took over a city called Zankal, and they renamed it, Messene. Good for them. Anyway, this revolt, the Second Messenian War, was a serious one, and it took a lot out of the Spartans. It took them 2 decades to put it down. Although the perioikoi, that's those who live around Sparta, although these people played a role in the Spartan economy, the Helots were the backbone of it. They had to be held in check. They couldn't be allowed to regain their independence. Otherwise, the Spartans' entire livelihood was in danger. And this is vividly shown some centuries later. In 371 BC, so we're jumping well ahead now, but you'll see the point I'm trying to make. In 371, the Thebans defeated the Spartans in a battle at Leuctra. And that brought to an end the period known as the Spartan hegemony of Greece. The following year, in 370, the Thebans invaded the Peloponnese. They liberated the Helots in Messenia. In fact, they helped them refound Messene, their old capital, the one that had been destroyed during that First Messenian War. Now, that liberation, making the Helots free again, knocked Sparta for six. It never attained its superpower status again. Gone was the Spartans' economic backbone. So you can see what I'm getting at. The dependence on the Helots and the scare from their revolt, what we call the Second Messenian War, may well have led to that radical transformation of society along those military lines that was the Agoge. First-class soldiers to keep in check what would always be a superior number of Helots. I mean, we've no idea what the ratio of Helots to Spartans is, but at the Battle of Plataea in 479, that's the last battle on the mainland of the Persian Wars, we're told that the Spartans sent 5,000 hoplites, and each soldier took 7 Helots with him. So that's 1 to 7. Now, they wouldn't have taken every Helot from Messenia to this battle. So we could be looking at a ratio of 1 to 10, 1 to 12. A conscript army would be no good against such numbers. So another reason for linking the Helots to the Agoge is that by the Spartans being released from farming the kleroi, they could focus on developing their army in such a way that they would always be better trained, have superior tactics, better arms and armor than the Helots that outnumbered them. There would never be another Helot revolt. And by making the Helots farm those kleroi, the Spartans had the leisure time to do this. Finally, the Krypteia, the secret police. This was perhaps staffed by the elite of the Agoge to spy on the Helots and make sure they didn't get up to anything naughty. We don't want another revolt, do we? The ephors were in charge of the Krypteia, And members of this secret police force had the right to kill dangerous helots. Just as every year there was an official period when any Spartan could go out and kill helots with impunity. The idea was to try to keep the numbers down. So there was helot culling season. There's no question then that the Spartans recognized the need for the helots economically and at the same time the dangers they posed to Sparta. And so they had to do something about it. This scenario makes sense, doesn't it? By all means, email me if you disagree or can suggest another. If the agoge developed out of the helot problem in the mid-7th century, then this gives us a date for Lycurgus if he did introduce it. Then again, as we talked about last time, the constitution that he brought back in the form of the Rhetora from Delphi has to predate the agoge. So it looks as though the agoge was ascribed to him just to give it a pedigree. Now, another offshoot of the helot problem was the development of the organization, the league, that was destined to become Sparta's empire, the Peloponnesian League. And so I move to the third and final part of my lecture now. Sparta had been gradually increasing its power in the Peloponnese over the years, but it had always been held in check by Argos, which dominated the north. And we've talked about this before. Argos became very powerful thanks to the rule of its tyrant, Phidon. In 546, the Spartans were finally able to defeat the Argives, and this was the launching point, if you like, to dominate the Peloponnese. Now, just to put this year an event in a sort of comparative context, this is the time when Pisistratus defeated the nobles at the Battle of Pallene and seized power in Athens for that third time. Anyway, after the defeat of the Argives, Sparta made an alliance with Elis, which was intent on re-establishing its authority at Olympia. Remember, its authority had been denuded by the activities of Phidon. And then another alliance quickly followed with Tegea in Arcadia. And so began the trend for a series of alliances with other Peloponnesian states and the formation of what modern historians call the Peloponnesian League. Now, there's not a precise date for when the League was formed, but it was clearly up and running by the time the Spartans interfered in Athens to bring the Pisistratid tyranny to an end in 510. The Peloponnesian League would eventually include all of the Peloponnese except Achaea and Argos. Argives never did like the Spartans. It also included some members outside of the Peloponnese. Early on, this included Thebes in Boeotia. And it's plausible to connect the helot threat to Spartan security with the formation of this league. The idea being that if the helots revolted again and the Spartans were hard pushed, they could count on allies for help. And in turn, they could offer help to any ally if it needed it. Now, in the Peloponnesian League, the Spartan allies swore an oath to support each other in times of war and to follow the lead of Sparta. To follow the lead of Sparta. That's important. No tribute was exacted by the Spartans except in times of war, and the Spartans were to be in charge of all military forces. The allies had their own synedrion or council, each state having one vote, but only Sparta could summon a meeting of the League. So Sparta dominated it from the outset. The Peloponnesian League enhanced the power and prestige of Sparta enormously, but it also drew the Spartans into the orbit of Greek affairs in a way that their society was ill-equipped to deal with. And soon another factor would draw Sparta into the orbit of Greek affairs, and that was the emergence of Persia on the Greek scene. In the next lecture, we round off our consideration of Sparta and we turn to the onset of the Persian Wars. And in the process, we turn to the cusp of the Archaic and the Classical periods. The Persian Wars mark the coming of age of Athens as a military power. After them, the Athenians will get their own league off the ground. Well, that's not going to go down very well with the Spartans, is it? And we'll see how the Athenians did this and why in future lectures. So it's Persian Wars next, and we start to leave the archaic period and move into the classical. Thank you very much.